I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush today expressed optimism about Iraq's upcoming elections. With the number of rebel attacks surging in recent weeks, the president told a group of reporters, "I know it's hard, but it's hard for a reason." Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting today that a retired top general has been asked to travel to Iraq to conduct a wholesale review of operations there. Joining us on the line from Washington is Eric Schmidt. He co-wrote the New York Times story today. Welcome, Eric, and tell us, who is this General Luck?
Well, Robin, Gary Luck is a former four-star Army general who was the commander of the 18th Airborne Division during the Persian Gulf War. He was also a former top commander of all American forces in South Korea. More recently, however, he has served as a special advisor to General Tommy Franks during the Iraq campaign, and he also is a special advisor to the military's Joint Forces Command, which does all the training for the military.
Why General Luck? What can he find out that all of the thousands of advisors and high-ranking generals on the ground don't already know?
Well, Robin, that's what some critics are asking today. What can he bring that all the forces and generals who've been studying this for months now don't know? But again, these guys get so wrapped up in their programs over there that sometimes you might miss certain things, and I think that's what Rumsfeld is counting on, that Luck, who has the advantage of being able to step back a little bit with his experience, might see something, again, in terms of emphasis, probably than any radical departures in which the military might be able to make some fixes.
Mm. Well, you write that other high-level visits to Iraq and Afghanistan to assess the situation, this is different because it's open-ended. What does that mean?
Well, that's what's interesting. In the past, there have been very specific missions that senior generals have been dispatched from Washington to undertake. Luck is basically going over. Obviously, he'll have an eye on the training of the Iraqi security forces. That's a linchpin of the American administration's exit strategy. But he's been basically given a very broad mandate by Mr. Rumsfeld to look at whatever else is going wrong, whether it be the insurgency, the strategy to counter the insurgency, the number of troops we have there, the schedule that they're on, reconstruction, the whole gamut of things that all combine to form the military's Iraq policy and strategy on the ground. It's being billed as basically bringing in somebody who's familiar with the region who can give a fresh assessment, but clearly what it indicates is the senior Pentagon officials and ground commanders in Iraq are very concerned about the directions things are going.
Well, Eric, one of the issues that General Luck will address is troop strength, and we're reading in your article and elsewhere that right now forces in Iraq are about a 50-50 split between active duty soldiers and reservists, but that's going to change because the Army is just running out of reserve units to call up. The head of the reserve said that, you know, his system is broken. Is this part of General Luck's evaluation, and what's the sense of how that might change?
Sure. Indirectly, it is, and obviously the linchpin for the administration's exit strategy from Iraq is to train enough Iraqi security forces to take over for the 150,000 American troops that are there now. What the Army general who was quoted in the article is saying, even if you do come down in numbers in Iraq, the Army is still going to need more flexibility to call on reservists more often and for longer time periods. And, oh, by the way, he said, we'll probably need a permanent increase of at least 30,000 forces in the future. So this is moving away from a direction that Rumsfeld was pointing the military when he came into office a little over 4 years ago, where he was trying to, again, make the Army and the military all kind of leaner, more agile, and yet still as lethal as it could. But now, as we're seeing more and more commitments on the ground in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, the Army is saying they just can't do it with the forces they have now.
Yeah. But as you said earlier, it's a clear sign that there's a recognition that there are problems. And one last question while we have you. Your colleague Paul Krugman wrote today that a respected Washington newsletter, the Nelson Report, says that President Bush has made it clear to those around him that he doesn't want to hear bad news about Iraq. So how does this story square with that information?
Well, it's hard to see how he can't hear bad news about Iraq because there's so much bad news coming out of Iraq right now, and clearly this may well be in response to that, that Rumsfeld and others are so concerned they're sending over this retired four-star general to take a look, see how they can perhaps correct things.
And maybe have it come from him.
Right, have it come from him. There's a crucial election at the end of the month in Iraq is crucial, and so I'm sure Luck will have his eye on that, what changes might be made. They don't know the exact shape of the new government that will come out of Baghdad for the Iraqis. So there's a lot of unknowns here, too, that Luck will have to consider when he's over in Iraq, kind of assessing the military situation on the ground.
Eric Schmidt, reporter for The New York Times, speaking to us from Washington. Eric, thank you.
You're welcome.
death toll continues to mount in the wake of the tsunami in South Asia. Today, 7,000 bodies were found in Indonesia in a town that had been cut out by washed-out roads. The total number of dead is approaching 150,000, and the UN warns more bodies will likely be found. Well, many people are calling on their faith to try and understand this tragedy. Was it part of a divine plan or an event that was part of the natural course of things and affected almost all faiths at this crossroads of religion? Joining us first, Omid Safi, chair of the Progressive Muslim Union and professor of Islamic Studies at Colgate University. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And I know you've been in touch with people in the region. What are some of the reactions from both the people who live there and the religious leaders there and the people who work there?
You know, there's tended to be two sets of responses. The first response is a core message of compassion that's pouring out in a very Quranic way of addressing the needs of the poor and those who are impoverished. That's a very consistent Quranic trope, in many ways one of the dominant ethical kind of imperatives from the Quran that people are relying upon at these times to get them through.
And we should point out that, for instance, Indonesia is largely Muslim.
Absolutely. It's, in fact, the most populous of the Muslim countries in the world. Malaysia is over 50% Muslim, and the eastern coast of Africa, which also has been hit by the tsunami, has a very large Muslim population. At the same time, there's also been a very fierce self-critical approach that a lot of Muslims have developed, basically asking the question of why have not some of the richer Muslim countries, particularly the Arab countries in the Gulf region, reached out more generously to the victims of the tsunami. And the response that many people have come up with, sadly speaking, is that there are elements of classism involved in this situation, namely that many of the people from Southeast Asia who live in the Arab Gulf region are people who tend to perform manual labor. For that reason, people have felt like had the catastrophe impacted the Arab Gulf region more directly, perhaps the outpouring of not just grief, but financial support would have been more pronounced.
Well, Omid, we hasten to point out, though, that Saudi Arabia, for instance, had a telethon.
They sure did.
And raised $77 million.
That's right. But Kuwait, for example, has been another country with a very huge budget surplus, which has been witnessing a large number of people criticizing its government for not being more generous.
And there were also some accusations in the beginning, in the very beginning, some internet statements that surfaced before it was known who the full extent of the tsunami and who the victims were. And when the initial pictures were just from Phuket in Thailand of vacationers from the West, there were statements coming up on the internet that this was punishment for the decadent Western lifestyle.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is that we see those kinds of statements coming from a number of different religious traditions. We have seen Muslims making those statements, we've seen Hindus making that statement, and we've also seen some Christians making that statement. I think those kinds of messages of, you know, well, this is caused by the sin and debauchery of people, I would really call that the scum rising to the top. It's the hatred that people have in their hearts that sometimes at moments of tension and crisis and tragedy is verbalized. But then we've also seen the cream rise to the top, and one is very delighted to be able to report that there are co-religionists with a more pluralistic outlook that have immediately confronted that message and said, look, this is a time of crisis. This is a time that we need to be reaching out to the victims in compassion and not simply be putting forward this dogmatic interpretation of our tradition.
And we noticed, too, that in particular, the ones that seemed to be coming from the Islamic world were quickly silenced because it became evident that a huge swath of the Muslim world was affected by this.
Was affected by it, and you know, furthermore, from a kind of theological perspective, it would just simply be absurd for anyone to hold that, let's say, a fisherman in Somalia might have her own family wiped away because of the sins of a five-star hotel in Indonesia. I mean, that's just not how the notion of a compassionate and just God operates in the Islamic tradition.
But Omid, what is that mother saying? I mean, we've been hearing for 2 weeks now the painful and horrific stories of, and there's another one in the Times this morning that's unbearable, of children ripped from parents' arms, parents watching their children drown, and people must be questioning their faith.
And well, they should. The only thing that I would hope is that maybe we can use moments of profound crisis like this to ask ourselves the question, why do we think of an act of God as being the only moments in which God supposedly intervenes in human history?
Some people wonder whether, in fact, it was an act of God. We're going to be talking in a moment with Diana Eck. She's the director of the Pluralism Project at Harvard University. But I first want to bring up a fascinating poll that's being taken on BeliefNet.com. That's a very popular religious website. Very unscientific survey. Obviously, it's just respondents who read the poll online. But people are asked what they thought God's role in the tragedy may have been. Here were some of the possibilities so that people listening can also start thinking, what do I think? One, do you think God is punishing us? Two, God is testing us? Three, the earthquake and tsunami were sent by God, but we don't know why. Four, I believe in God, but I don't believe that he had anything to do with this tragedy. Or five, I don't believe in God, and disasters like this are just forces of nature. The overwhelming choice of most of the respondents, I believe in God, but he had nothing to do with the tsunami. In other words, nature, science, in some cases we've heard people say God might have created nature, but then nature is on its own. What are you hearing from people, Omid?
There are some people who are very comfortable with the notion of the God who creates and then sits back from creation. And I would actually argue that that's a sort of very sterile model of the universe. And it's in fact many of the people who tend to have the more dynamic notion of a God who intervenes in human history at each and every breath who are most challenged by this crisis. I would count myself as among them. I would see an act of God not merely through an earthquake or a tsunami, but every time that there's a child born, anytime you see a smile on the face of a beloved, anytime we reach out in compassion to one another, I see that as God acting in human history.
It's sort of the Job point of view, if you will. You might question, you might get angry, but you develop a deeper relationship with God in asking why it happened.
That's right, through that process of wrestling with God. So that in that sense, it's a relationship that is perpetually deepened through that kind of struggle with God.
But Omid, what one reason could you come up with that a God might have done this?
I actually do not attempt to come up with a reason. I would actually see this as a time to be silent, to be devastated, and to be brokenhearted, and then to attempt to reach out in compassion to people, not as a time to be coming up with a newfangled theological explanation.
Omid Safi is chair of the Progressive Muslim Union and professor of Islamic studies at Colgate University. Well, many other people are still searching for explanations, Omid, and they're asking questions. When we come back, we'll have more results from the BeliefNet web poll. We'll hear how the tragedy is bringing faiths together, but also how leaders from some different faiths are using the tragedy as an opportunity to convert others or instill fear through faith. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our look at faith in the wake of the Indian Ocean tsunami, we mentioned that very unscientific poll is being taken at BeliefNet.com, the popular religious website. It asks, what was God's role in the tsunami? Now, currently, 3% of the respondents say God is punishing us, 8% say God is testing us, 30% say God sent the tsunami, but we don't know why. 50% say they believe in God but don't think he had anything to do with the tsunami. 9% say they don't believe in God. The disaster was a force of nature. Well, we've been speaking with Omid Safi, chair of the Progressive Muslim Union and professor of Islamic studies at Colgate University. Omid, welcome again.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Diana Eck, the director of the Pluralism Project at Harvard University. Diana, welcome.
Great to be here, Robin.
And I know you've been listening with great interest. You've also been in touch with people in the region, aid workers, people on the ground, people who live there, Lutheran tourists returning back to Sweden. People are asking, why did this happen? What are their answers?
I think the why question is, as Omid said, a very difficult one right now. I think that the reason so many people in the BeliefNet poll said that they believe in God but don't think God had anything to do with this tsunami is that the mystery of this kind of natural disaster though explained in some ways by the scientists who have talked about the tectonic plates and the sources of tsunami waves, is something that does make us fall silent in the face of nature and in the face of God.
And in fact, we were talking to a relief worker earlier this week in Sri Lanka. He said people were struck dumb by this tragedy. They're speechless, and they can't comprehend what happened.
I think the comprehension is, as Omid says, something that comes later in some ways. And yet, the religious question is not really the question of why did it happen or explaining it. It's the response that we have to it. And I think one of the most amazing things to me has been the ways in which people of many religious communities have responded together to this in South and Southeast Asia. Certainly in India, where one reads the reports of the shrines along the eastern coast of India, South India and Tamil Nadu, there are a couple of shrines very close together there, the Great Marian Shrine of Vailankani, which was filled with people. It's a big basilica within half a kilometer of the ocean. And similarly, a few miles away at the Muslim Saint Shrine in Nagore, where there's a mausoleum for a very powerful, healing Muslim saint, the people who gathered inside that for protection at the time of the disaster were Muslims and Hindus and Christians. And there was a sense that this kind of disaster yields and reveals to us our most deeply human commonality and erases the religious differences.
Well, and but we should say that different faiths have different approaches to this, as you well know. I mean, there are also Buddhists and Hindus in the region, in addition to the Muslims and Christians that we've been speaking primarily of, and they see this as part of a cycle in some cases.
Well, there certainly is a sense that the natural world and the human world are not divided into separate segments. That there is a kind of earth body, so to speak, that we are a part of, that nothing stands separate. There are many other responses, though, that I think are really quite touching and significant. The fact that for many Hindus, an untimely death, such as we've seen here, really calls for special kinds of prayers, recognizing that both for families and for the souls of the departed, being killed in an instant, in an overwhelming wave, means something slightly different in the ways in which we grieve.
But the Buddhists, we read, believe that this kind of suffering is caused by attachments to worldly things, and it's about encouraging you to not have those attachments. Is that too facile?
In a way, it is. I mean, I think the Buddhist tradition, like many religious traditions, is really about how we respond to suffering. The first of the great noble truths of Buddhism is that suffering exists.
I want to bring Omid Safi back into the conversation because, Omid, we were talking about the Muslims in the region, the many Muslims in the region, and we have been reading there as well that while some may be questioning their faith, there are others who saw that only mosques remained standing in huge areas, and there was a message there that drove them deeper into their faith. You know, the message was to go deeper into your mosque and into your faith.
The task of different religious traditions at times like this isn't necessarily to explain the mind of God or the heart of God. It's to help shape human responses.
We should point out there's been some opportunistic moments in the past 2 weeks. It sounds obscene, but we talked earlier about how immediately there were some internet messages from the Islamic world saying that this was a punishment of heathen Christians. On the other side of the spectrum, there was an evangelical Christian preacher in Hong Kong who urged his congregation to now try to convert the Muslim nations because they are vulnerable now.
So let me counter that, Robin, because there were some in India, in the Hindu tradition, who were also labeled extremists immediately, who felt that this was the Christmas tsunami. This was the thing that happened on Christmas. This was the thing that hit the big Marian shrine in South India. This was God's sign that Christian missionaries ought to get out of India.
And there have been voices from this country as well, we should say.
Certainly, I think extremist voices and I would say solitary voices in some way, like the very extremist fundamentalist minister in the Midwest who immediately said, well, thank God 2,000 Swedes are dead because the Swedes are those licentious people, homosexuals who have a lot of free time on their hands and and disposable income and are vacationing there, and they deserved it.
So
there are all sorts of interpretations. Once we start trying to imagine what the will of God is, whatever one might mean by that, we're in deep trouble. Mm. We need to be very attentive to human suffering at this time and respond to that as what we know for sure the will of God is.
Diana Echt is director of the Pluralism Project at Harvard University, and also we've been talking to Omid Safi, professor of Islamic Studies and Comparative Religion at Colgate University in Hamilton, New York. Thank you both.
Thank you for having us.
And by the way, for more on the BeliefNet online poll, go to our website, here-now.org. By the way, Diana told us that if you feel you're losing your faith, one way to find it is to reach out and help someone who's been affected by the tsunami. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As violence in Iraq continues in advance of this month's election, it's believed that the insurgents are mostly Sunni Muslims, who are in the minority. The majority Shiites are expected to dominate in the January 30th polling. Iran, a Shiite country, is also believed to be playing a role in Iraq's election. Last month, the King of Jordan accused the Iranian government of encouraging more than 1 million Iranians to travel to Iraq to support the election of a Shiite government. Vivian Walt is in Tehran. She writes for Time magazine, and recently I asked her, how much is Iran interfering in the upcoming Iraqi elections?
Robin, I think there's no doubt that there are probably countless, hundreds, thousands, no one quite knows how many Iranian operatives of various kinds inside Iraq. The Iranian officials that I've been speaking to all week in Tehran have tacitly kind of acknowledged it. They acknowledge that this is a deeply personal issue for them. This is at last their moment to get allies into power after suffering through decades of Saddam's rule in Iraq.
Well, and to review, Saddam Hussein favored the minority Sunni population in Iraq. It's thought the majority Shiites are going to win the election without any help from Iran. But can you sense, how are they recruiting Iranians in Iran to go to Iraq? Can you see it?
Well, firstly, there is always a very steady stream of Iranians into Iraq anyway. There are hundreds of thousands of people who go on religious pilgrimages every year. And one of the top Iranian officials that I interviewed denied that they were sending money to the Shiite parties. I think we can pretty much safely assume that they are either through private charities, which are very closely aligned to the government, or otherwise through private donations. But in addition to that, they have been very, very vocally behind the Grand Ayatollah Sistani.
Well, let's take a look at Iran. You are there. Iran has elections of its own coming up, but it was announced this week they'll be on June 17th. They will replace President Mohammad Khatami, who's barred from running for a third term. Khatami ran on a reform platform, but ran into stiff opposition from the conservative Guardian Council, which answers to Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. So if a reformer couldn't get anything done, what's the thinking about the upcoming election and what it might produce?
Well, I think everybody expects that the conservatives already have it locked up. And in fact, all the speculation in the press is that basically the supreme leader, the Ayatollahs who run this country, will basically have their man already picked out, and it will simply be a pro forma matter when the election rolls around in June. There's tremendous sort of apathy here. It's really interesting and such a contrast from 8 years ago when Khatami was swept to power in this incredible feeling of everything changing in Iran.
Well, and we remember when the hardliners barred reformist candidates from running in the February 2004 parliamentary elections. There was that takeover, that sit-in in parliament, but still the hardliners won out. So is there a sense that the Reform Party's candidate would even have a chance to run? Would he be disqualified?
Nobody expects that that he will be allowed to run. He's put his name forward, but nobody really expects it to be a serious candidacy.
Since we're talking about Iran's upcoming election, how is the issue of Iran's nuclear program resonating in this election? We read that there are those who believe that Iran must develop nuclear weapons in order to be more secure and not cave into the demands of the West. Even those who are against nuclear weapons resent outside interference in a weapons program. What are you hearing?
Even reformists that I speak to here in Tehran will defend the nuclear program. It seems to be quite a unifying force in this country, and I think there are a couple of reasons for that. The one is that Iranians particularly do not like to be dictated to. So in a sense, it's a matter of national pride. The other issue is that they say, well, Israel has nuclear weapons, and so does the U.S., and therefore, what's the difference? Why is it that we cannot have it? I mean, most people do not support the country having use of a nuclear weapon, but they don't want the feeling of this being a bargaining chip by the West.
You were last in Iran 3 years ago. What are the changes that you've seen this time around?
Well, there's some amazing changes, actually. And even though the young Tehranis here will tell you that Khatami has been a big failure and there's been no change from reform, one only has to land in Tehran to see the changes from 3 years ago. I, for example, when I left my home in Europe, took out my Iran outfit, which is a long black coat and a black headscarf. And, of course, the moment I arrived in Tehran, I realized I was dressed completely wrong and that all the women around me were dressed in pink headscarves and coats that came up to just below their knee, blue jeans rolled up, sneakers, very Americanized. This is something that really is visually completely a jolt when you arrive after a three-year absence and can only really be put down to there having been a real reform movement in this country. The undercurrent of that, unfortunately, is that they feel that the reform movement is on the wane. When I was here 3 years ago, it was on the upswing. There was this tremendous feeling of optimism. Now there's a tremendous feeling of defeatism and apathy.
But still, as you and others have told us, these are now Iranians who are chatting on cell phones and on weblogs. And you just described a government that is sort of trying to steal the election, really, and make sure that their conservative candidate wins. Do you have any sense of a Ukrainian-type outcome come election day in Iran, or is that just are the two situations not comparable?
I find it very hard to believe that that would be a possibility. If only because I don't think you will have a kind of Yushchenko-type candidate here. The mullahs who run this country will not make the same mistake twice. Khatami got in by mistake. Nobody expected him to win, and nobody took much notice of him until it was really too late and suddenly he was president. That is really not likely to happen again. And I think certainly the young generation, which is really the majority of this country, knows that, and they won't come out in large numbers and vote. Certainly everybody I speak to, when I ask them if they're going to vote, sort of looks at me as if, you know, I've asked if they're going to, you know, go skiing in Europe this winter or something. Mm. It's just something that's absolutely not on their agenda. And so I think that you just will not have the mass movement around the election at all.
Vivian Walt writes for Time Magazine, speaking to us from Tehran. Vivian, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Still to come, the Syringa Tree, the powerful story of living under South African apartheid. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, historians will debate how 2004 will be seen in the history books, but how will it go down in the dictionary? Perhaps we'll remember it as the year a candidate was accused of flip-flopping, Ohio became a purple state, or Janet Jackson claimed that wardrobe malfunction. Yeah, right. Well, these and other phrases are being considered by the American Dialect Society as Word of the Year, that phrase or word that sums up the year past. Grant Barrett is editor of the Historical Dictionary of American Slang. He's at the Society's meeting in Oakland, California, and Grant, before we look at this year's nomination list, let's look back at past winners. Some of them have stuck around, some haven't.
Yes, that's right. I think one of them was Bush Lips in 93 or 94, which did not last.
Bush Lips?
Bush Lips, yes. It was a phrase. Remember when the first President Bush said, read my lips, no new taxes? Well, a lot of people said Bush Lips, something to be distrusted. But nothing really.
Well, see, I already forgot it. I had no idea. So obviously that didn't succeed. But let's look at some that are up in contention this year. Hillbilly armor.
I think that's got a great shot. As long as we stay in Iraq and as long as we have soldiers coming back, they can continue to bring that jargon back. Angel is another one, which is the name for soldiers who were killed in action. The military will continue to be a great source for words.
Well, hillbilly armor, again, is the this sort of spackled-together armor that they've been putting on their own vehicles in Iraq. Another source was technology. I'm thinking of podcasting and, well, wiki from Wikipedia. What is that word?
Wiki is not a new word, but I really think it came to prominence last year, which is why I nominated it. A wiki is a Hawaiian word, which means quick, and it's usually a reduplicated word, which means they say it twice, wiki-wiki, which means very fast. And a wiki is a website which can be edited by anyone. So there's the Wiktionary, which is a dictionary of words where people can submit their own words or change other people's definitions, and
right.
Wikipedia as well.
So that's one of your nominations. Tell us some others that came from technology.
Spam, instant messaging spam, I think that's a logical one, although I think what's happening more and more is people are just applying spam to any unwanted commercial content. I have people telling me the paper mail they receive in their old school mailbox, that is spam. So spam is a fun one, but it may not last.
Yeah.
Podcasting is another one.
Podcasting, and what does that mean?
That is when people make their own media files for people to download to their iPods automatically.
I have not gotten there yet. Some of the words are just plain fun. I mean, there's always some every year that people just like. I love redonkulous, which is so ridiculous.
Yeah, the redonkulous. And the fun thing about that one is you can tell by the number of spellings that there are for redonkulous that it's primarily an oral word. It's something that people say more than they write because people aren't quite sure what the rule is on how to spell it.
Don't be redonkulous.
Where does that U go?
Right. And crunk is one that we've discussed at great length on this program, mad crunk in particular.
Sure, mad. Mad everything. Mad is an adjective or as an adverb even. Mad is a great one. People say things like, I have mad books. No, I have lots of books, I guess.
Crunk, we learned on this program, was from sort of the southern hip-hop scene.
Yeah, Atlanta and Houston are fighting over which one of them coined it.
There are some serious words on your list as well. Christianophobia, and of course, backdoor draft, a very serious thing for the military families. This is filling military jobs through reactivating former troops or through extending enlistments. That was hugely popular, or unpopular, I should say, phrase this year.
We haven't seen the end of that one, that's for sure. Although the first citation I found was 1999, it did become more common during the election, but it wasn't something that John Kerry brought up or his people. It actually was brought up by soldiers in the field who said, we don't have the resources to carry out this effort.
We're 1 week into 2005. I'm wondering, are there words that came at the end of the year that might sneak their way into today's competition?
I think given the depths and Asia, I think Tsunami will be on more than one nomination list. We do take nominations to the last minute. Anyone here can nominate and vote. So you don't even have to be a linguist, because we're all protectors of the English language. We all use it every day. It's a tool that belongs to everyone.
One last question to you, Grant. What word do you like?
I am cheering for FLOHPA. F-L-O-H-P-A. It's the combination of the postal codes for Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, and supposedly they were the most important states in the election.
Oh, that's right. FLOHPA? People use that?
They did use it. It actually shows up in CNN transcripts, MSNBC transcripts. It actually came out of people's mouths.
Where was I? Grant Barrett, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Grant Barrett is at the American Dialect Society meeting in Oakland, California today. To find out this year's word candidates for Word of the Year, go to Grant's website. Visit here-now.org to do both things. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It began as an acting class exercise. Now it's an award-winning one-woman play. It's called The Syringa Tree, Pamela Geen's fictionalized account of growing up white in a South Africa under apartheid. Pamela plays all 26 characters, sometimes several in the space of a few seconds, in this searing account of a white family which loves its homeland but hates South Africa's racist policies. In this scene, Pamela plays first a beloved black gardener, then herself as a child, then a policeman, warning blacks to get out of the white suburbs by nightfall. The Syringa Tree will soon be made into a film and novel, but Pamela is currently performing it as part of the American Repertory Theater's South African Festival here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We asked her, how close to the truth does it come?
The play now is a fictional story in the end, but it is based on two true incidents. And those incidents are the murder of my grandfather on his farm, which was called Clover, when I was 10 years old, and then also a black child that was born at my house, and my dad is a physician, and he did deliver this little baby at night. We hid her away because of the legal circumstance with apartheid at the time. And so I think taking those two main incidents and spinning the story from those two really speaks to a lot of my feeling about my life there, but it's not my actual life.
But it's close enough that, you know, one's jaw drops watching you be alternately a 6-year-old, a 10-year-old, your own mother, your grandmother, your grandfather, your black nanny, your her child. You've written that it also produced these memories of these black women, largely, who cared for you and raised you, something you could still feel against your skin. Do I have that right?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's a memory so many South Africans carry with us, and many people in this country also. You know, I've had many, many letters from people who say, I was born in the South, I was raised by a black woman who cared for me, who I still remember the smell of her. You know, and it's so interesting, the smell of the skin and the maternal instinct of the person who cared for us as very young children, that we never forget that. And Salamina, the character, one of the main characters in the play, is based on two different women who took care of me. And I remember them as if they were standing in front of me right now.
In fact, we have a scene where Salamina, your caretaker, and Elizabeth, who is your character as a child, meet with Zephyr, who's the gardener of a neighbor. In that portion, we hear a reference to the song Shoshaloza?
Exactly.
What is that?
Shoshaloza is a traditional work song that the miners used to sing coming down from Rhodesia to the gold mines. And the words of the song are quite simple, and they really mean the little white train is bringing us through the mountains, keep going, keep going. But there's a longing in the song for the green of the hills of Rhodesia, where they come from. It has you know, the other meaning, which is really for the black struggle in South Africa, keep going, keep going. It's the working song. It's for us to remember really what it took, all those years of resistance and all the unsung heroes.
As I hear you speak, it's reminding me that when I've spoken of your play to others, when I say that it's about the experience of a white South African, that you feel a little resistance at first because whites in South Africa were the enemy in the apartheid movement. Your play, you know, speaks to the pain of everyone involved in South Africa. Who was your family in the middle of this? What did they stand for?
I'm so glad you asked me that. You know, it's such a... As I began to write, it just opened a well of feeling in me of love for a place that I truly adored. And what's wonderful about the Syringa Tree is that it's not a political drama that sort of hits you over the head with a message of what to think politically of, you know, black or white. Or it's really a story of a family. It's an epic story spanning four generations of a family. And this could be my family. It could be any South African family. And there were many, many families like this who really, you know, tried to do what they could to help on a one-on-one basis.
And these are white families.
White families, yeah. And yet we lived in a system that dictated that we were separate from the black by law. But then on a daily basis, we were engaged in the most intimate, deep friendships with the people who worked in our homes. They were like a part of our family. So it was an extremely confusing thing. And I think it took me a long, long time to unravel it and to work it all out and to understand what it meant that somebody who called himself a freedom fighter walked into my grandparents' farmhouse that had no lock on the doors because they were not afraid of anyone. They had black workers who just adored them. Walked into the farmhouse and murdered an 82-year-old man in the name of freedom, and then trying to put that next to the children of Soweto who walked in the streets with the most extraordinary bravery to say, no, we will stand up.
You mentioned the freedom fighter killing your grandfather. How could he have known that your mother risked her life for the black child of a servant, that your father also took risky steps? So there were secrets everywhere. And deep, deep love. I want to go back to that deep love that you had for these people who helped bring you up, and then you left the country and left them behind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such a wonderful point that you make. You know, it's very easy to generalize. There were so many black people who would have felt ashamed of the man who stabbed an 82-year-old man. There were so many Afrikaans people who had hearts of gold, who worked for change, that are unsung heroes. You know, I think a lot of the joy of the play for me, and there's a lot of, you know, I just want to say too, there's an enormous amount of humor and fun and joy in the play also. A lot of it, I think, was awakened when I began to write and I started to remember just the exquisite gift of being born a child in Africa, being able to smell that air and be with those people and hear the rhythms at night and just that extraordinary life there.
In the end of the play, you go back, your character goes back to find this nanny who was so important to you. Did you do that? Have you seen these people since?
I have. I went back last year. It really was such a journey of the heart, you know. We're taking Syringa Tree there now in February, so I'm thrilled to be going back again. But I had this miraculous reunion where it was almost like the play coming to life in a way. You know, even now, and I think of what that really meant to me, and I know from them that it meant an enormous amount to them. And Salamina and Caroline, who was my actual, like, real Salamina, said to me, "Pemi, if you could see my heart, it is white as snow that you came to find me." And just that, I mean, just the gift of that in my life, to know that I've had this chance to reunite with her. This is one of the gifts of this place. So great.
Pamela Gein's eyes still well up as she talks about that reunion. In the Syringa Tree, the last words are spoken by the character playing her nanny.
To open our heart with joy. We are free. We are free.
Writer and performer Pamela Gein. The Syringa Tree is currently being staged at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. And this note, yesterday, South Africa's Nelson Mandela made a statement revealing that his son, who died this week, succumbed to AIDS. Mandela said he hoped to bring attention to the deadly disease. Well, next week on Here and Now, a troubling report about an American-run AIDS program in Africa. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.